Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just weeks after U.S.-led forces toppled the Taliban, in January 2002, young Rory Stewart stood at the western edge of Afghanistan, ready, incredibly, to walk in winter through mountains across a famously rugged country torn by decades of infamously brutal war. The young Scotsman was no naive fool. He had already walked across much of Asia, served as a British diplomat, tutored the British royals Prince William and Prince Harry. Now he was far from any palace grounds, in Kipling country with Kalashnikovs, walking village by mountain pass through country that is still confounding American troops. Up next on Point, the remarkable story of Rory Stewart's impossible journey and the unfinished challenge of Afghanistan. We'll hear from Rory Stewart in a moment, but first, for the latest on a new surge of fighting in Afghanistan, I turn to Carlotta Gall, reporter for The New York Times. She joins us from Kabul. Carlotta, thanks very much for being with us. What's going on with the Taliban these days?
They're very strong. This year particularly, we've seen a lot of activity, especially in southern Afghanistan, with a large number of Taliban across about five provinces, and they're hitting coalition troops and government troops almost every day. So it's a dramatic resurgence of the Taliban militia.
We saw this horrible story just in the last day or two of two convoys ambushed when they were carrying a dead member of the family, 30 people, most of the relatives of the dead, killed. What was that about? Why such brutality?
Well, I think it just shows you the level of the Taliban, and they ambushed one vehicle of a former government official, so that was probably a targeted attack. And then when people came to his aid from the nearby town, they ran into a second ambush and had a very hard and fast fight for hours, actually. It went on all day. So, and that's how most people were killed. So it just shows the level of the Taliban. And that they're there in large numbers, and they're ready to put up a fight, which is quite a dramatic change from previous years.
Now, we're also in the midst of a large offensive, U.S. troops and others. Can you describe that for us, Carlotta?
Yeah, it's called Operation Mountain Thrust, and it's been a long time in the planning, but it's come quite late in the summer with the Taliban already very active. But now about 11,000 troops, both coalition and NATO and Afghan troops, are moving across the provinces of the south to try and tackle these insurgents. But I think they've got quite a fight on their hands because there's so many groups in so many scattered remote places. And they are encountering groups of Taliban virtually every day. The British are up in Helmand, and Americans, Romanians ran into trouble yesterday. There are Dutch up in Uruzgan. I mean, it's a big operation across half the country. We're waiting to see what an impact it's going to have, but it's not going to be quick, that's for sure.
Carlotta, this is hard to take on board. Americans, I think, still have the memory of Taliban being toppled, sort of chased out of the country. We've been focused on Iraq. Are you saying that the Taliban is, I don't know, that they're back in charge in significant parts of Afghanistan, or they're just infiltrating? What's the level of influence? Is the Taliban back?
They are back. They're definitely back in the villages in the south. You can't say they're in charge in the sense that they don't hold ground, they don't hold any district centers, but they often raid police stations and overrun them at night, and then they leave. So they're very much an insurgency, and in that sense, the military can often hit them when they encounter them, hit them quite hard. But what it does mean is that they are moving very freely through a lot of the villages in the south, which are very remote places. There's often only dirt roads, miles between villages. There's lots of deserts and mountain spaces as well. And so the Taliban turn up in a village and there's no police, so of course they hold sway and the villagers do what they're told, or at least, you know, some of them might help them, but most of them do what they're told because they've got guns. So they're a very ominous presence throughout the villages of the south, and it's not at all clear what happens next. Their plan is to take power back again. Most people you talk to, Afghans down there, say, well, they can't, they never will against the coalition. But their presence is there, so, and how does one get rid of it? It's actually intractable, I think.
NATO forces supposed to be moving into this area, taking the lead role fairly soon. Will they follow a similar strategy to the U.S., which I guess clearly has not entirely worked here, or something different?
Yeah, well, they're trying something different, I think, and they're saying they're already in the provinces, but they're still building up their forces. They say they will have more troops on the ground than ever, than the Americans ever had, which is true. For example, places like Helmand, there's going to be 3,000 British troops. And before that, there were only a few hundred American special forces based there and no Afghan forces. So there is a change on the ground, but whether it's too little too late, we're not sure. We're going to have to see. And even General Eikenbry, the U.S. commander of forces here, is saying we'll have a very hot summer and we'll have to see by winter we should have turned it around. But it's a very big job. And NATO, of course, are coming in and they're only learning now. It's a first time for many of them to be operating in what is very difficult terrain. So the jury is certainly out for now as whether they'll be able to do it.
Well, a story we thought was supposed to be going the other way. Carlotta Gall, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you.
Carlotta Gall, reporter for the New York Times. She joined us from Kabul. We're talking this hour about a walk across war-torn Afghanistan. Joining me now from London is our guide, writer, diplomat, and hardy explorer, Rory Stewart. From 2000 to 2002, he walked 6,000 miles from Turkey to Bangladesh. He set out on his last stretch across Afghanistan in January 2002. He's also former deputy governor of the Maysan province in Iraq and was awarded the Order of the British Empire by the British government for his services there. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Granta, and the London Review of Books. His new book, and it really is terrific, is called The Places in Between. Rory Stewart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Please place yourself for us there in January of 2002. You were 20-something, standing at the western edge of Afghanistan, ready to embark on a walk pretty much across the entire country. Introduce yourself standing there a little bit. Who was Rory Stewart standing there?
Well, I was a man who'd been born in Hong Kong, grew up in Malaysia. I'd just walked for about 20 months. I'd stayed in about 450 village houses in Iran and Pakistan and India. But I was now hoping, just a few weeks after the fall of the Taliban, to cross the central mountains of Afghanistan following a route which was first done 500 years before by the Emperor Babur, who went on to be the first Mughal Emperor of India.
Babur, who became your kind of guiding light, at least in the text he left behind as you walked across, you were son of a British diplomat, born in Hong Kong, Eton and Oxford, so the fancy education pedigrees, but it wasn't exactly fancy the way you were planning to travel. You'd already walked across Turkey and Iran and India and Nepal. What was your kit? What was your modus operandi?
Well, I try to travel as light as possible because, as you can imagine, every morning when you wake up, you resent every extra pound in your pack. So just before I started, a friend sat down with me and we threw out my tent and my cooking equipment and my head torch and my blister packs. So really, I was just carrying warm clothing, a sleeping bag and a waterproof cover for the sleeping bag. And I didn't carry a map with me because I didn't want people to think I was a spy. One of the problems with being an ex-British diplomat walking through that territory is I was concerned that if any Islamist groups kidnapped me, they would immediately accuse me of being on some kind of spying mission.
You were 20 what, as you stood there in Herat in Afghanistan?
I was 28.
28, already had been in the diplomatic service, been a tutor to Prince William and Prince Harry?
That's right.
How did that come about? Are you close to the royal family? They picked you out of an Oxford lineup. Why?
I'm not really sure why that happened. I was given an interview by the Prince of Wales, and he very kindly asked me to do it. But I was a very young kid then. I was just 18. This was a summer job before I went up to university.
But it's a very British pedigree and kind of a British undertaking here. I'm looking at the Daily Telegraph from just a few days ago.
They describe you as a figure from a bygone age, imperial heroic, a Lawrence of Arabia who has somehow slipped through a crack in the space-time continuum, a Kipling hero, an intrepid Englishman or Scotsman, a nutter. At one point in the book, you say that some British troops call, nutter out at you as you're walking through the high mountains. You say you take that as a high compliment.
Well, this was a great moment. I was walking in an area in a blizzard, and I hadn't seen a vehicle for about 8 days. And I'd got quite lost on this mountainside with my dog. And the blizzard was blowing into my face, and I came down off the mountainside, and suddenly I saw coming towards me, bumping along the track, these two vehicles. And one of them drew up alongside me, and the electric window came down, and this head popped out of a special forces soldier I'd worked with in Yugoslavia. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "You are a nutter." And then he put up the windscreen again and then he just drove off.
And you smiled for hours.
And I smiled for hours.
It's got to mean something to a Britishman, a Scotsman, that it might not mean to an American. What's it mean?
Well, for me, I think particularly operating with the army, I think being accused of being mad is a kind of compliment. And I got the sense that he quite enjoyed the fact that he hadn't seen me for 3 years and he'd last seen me in Montenegro just after the Kosovo War, and now he was seeing me walking through a blizzard in central Afghanistan.
Rory Stewart, you were picked up by Afghan security before you even got underway. They sat you down and said, "Look, mister," quoting them from your book here, they said, "It is midwinter. There are 3 meters of snow on the high passes. There are wolves, and this is a war. You will die, I can guarantee. Do you want to die?" What was your answer? Why were you doing this exactly?
I think having been born in Hong Kong and grown up in Malaysia and spent a lot of my life living in Asian cities, I increasingly believed that if I really wanted to understand a country like Afghanistan or even the other countries in Central Asia I walked through, it was important to be in the villages. Because they're nestled in these very small valleys in Central Afghanistan, you get very, very particular and unique aspects of culture. These are communities where often people, the women in the village haven't been more than 3 hours walk from the village in their lives, where people often speak very different dialects, where there's often no road access at all, particularly during the winter months. And so for somebody like me who's been involved in politics and international relations and has worked in the Foreign Service, I thought it was very important to really try to have a sense of how things work at a very local and particular level.
A place where the only foreign technology in many a household, as you describe it, might be a Kalashnikov. Describe the topography for us. Here you are, Herat, near the Iranian border in western Afghanistan. You're headed for Kabul, which is almost all the way to the eastern border. What's it like between Herat and Kabul?
Well, traditionally, people walking from Herat to Kabul, and people did do it. Alexander the Great, for example, did it with his army 2,300 years ago, usually went either south through Kandahar, which was the route that Alexander took and the route that a lot of the hippie buses took, or north through Mazar-e-Sharif. The central mountains of Afghanistan have this very fearsome reputation, so much so that Aristotle believed that these represented the eastern edge of the earth. He called them the Parapamisus. And one of the reasons Alexander didn't walk through these mountains, which he might have done because he was trying to pursue a Persian king who fled that way, was that his tutor had been Aristotle and he believed that he would come to the end of the earth. So for me, it had this great allure to have a look at this, particularly as somebody from a British family that spent a lot of the last 200 years living in Asia. We see Afghanistan and the climate and the extremity of Afghanistan very much through the medium of the three incredible defeats the British army suffered in Afghanistan during the 19th century. Where a lot of our soldiers died in the snow and were defeated as much by the landscape as we were by the people.
You were reminded of that along the way, as I recall, by a veterinarian at one point who quotes chapter and verse for you of how many British were killed and who was remaining. The Afghans don't forget that they've defeated plenty of foreign invaders.
Exactly, and are very proud of it. And they would say to me that the great thing in 1842, when they obliterated the British army, they left one man alive called Dr. Bryden.
Right.
Who limped in on his horse into Jalalabad. So this man said to me, "We will let you go like Dr. Bryden."
You know, the last time I was in Afghanistan was a long, long time ago. I almost died in a public hospital in Kabul, took that southern route, saw lots of these kind of mud fortresses that you describe. But that is entirely, and did some hitchhiking out of there, but that's entirely different than walking over those mountains. I really can't Imagine, and it was winter. How high, how deep the snow, how far between the villages? What was it like day to day?
Well, it was quite difficult, but perhaps not as dangerous as you putting yourself in a public hospital in Kabul. That's something I'd never do.
I had no choice. It was meat poisoning, but anyway.
No, the snow up, as they said, on the high passes is between 2 and 3 meters deep, and the roads in that area are really only open from June until September. But I didn't actually go that high. The highest pass I crossed was probably about 14,000 feet. High enough, but not...
See, that's higher than Mount Fuji. That's higher than a lot of mountains in this world.
And the other thing is that so long as there wasn't a blizzard, one of the great advantages of snow, of course, is that I could often follow tracks from one village to another. And that's, of course, also very useful because of the number of minefields in that part of the world. So it's very useful to know that you're walking in the footsteps of someone else.
Now, describe what it took in terms of working the local power structure to make this journey, because you were confronted again and again as to what you were doing here in situations where you might well have been robbed or beaten or worse, killed. You began with a kind of offhand blessing from a warlord that set you on your way. And how did you work the politics in your own behalf to make this trip possible?
Well, this is very much a status-conscious society and a society where power structures are very, very closely connected to things like landholding. This meant that a lot of the time, survival wasn't so much about physical stamina as it was about making contacts, making friends, and even dropping names. So crossing, for example, central Hazarajat, if somebody wouldn't take me into their house, I'd make a great play of saying, oh, I've just come from Sangizat, where I stayed with Bushir Khan, and then I was in Katlish and Taras, where I stayed with Mir Ali Yazdan Bakhsh, and then I was in Kalenao, where I stayed with Said Karbalahi. And I would hope that by naming all these people, who everybody would know, even though these men were often their enemies, even though they often hadn't seen them for 10 or 15 years, because there were vendettas between the villages, these names had great resonances. And the sense that I had been entertained and treated as a guest by other villages then became a matter of pride for the next village along the way.
You describe how you were perceived along that way by villagers who are sometimes very, very deep in their local culture. There's one where an old villager is taking you on board, and the security folks who are traveling with you, very silent, very grave. I wish you'd perhaps give us a reading there.
Right, so we'll just open it up in my book. This was a very interesting moment because this was a moment, as you say, just after the fall of the Taliban. So a lot of these structures were very new. I'm walking along with three very sinister members of the security service who I'm trying to get rid of.
You'd been required to have them along with you on your first bit of the walk here anyway, yes.
Absolutely. And they were strange, half-modern figures. I mean, these were people who'd worked in Iran in truck stops as refugees and had come back now and had been given guns. And we were going into a very traditional part of the country. So the passage runs like this. Silent and gravely polite in his traditional clothes, the old man poured our tea and then leaned back against the mosque wall, staring at Abdul Haq. These men were all that he had seen of the new administration. What impression of the government did he derive from the restless, half-modern, young Abdul Haq with his foreign equipment and muddled past? Abdul Haq sat down beside us and helped himself to a biscuit. There are bad men here, he whispered to me. And taking my hand, he added, in a parody of my Persian accent, Man Haraji Hastam, I am a foreigner. Then standing up, he stuck the barrel of his rifle in the sand, performed a pole vault, hopped twice on his left foot, and grinned. The old man remained expressionless for a moment and then laughed. The old villager paid no taxes and received nothing from the state. Government was something that happened in grand, bullet-scarred buildings in Herat and Kabul. There, 3 weeks after the Taliban had gone, civil servants were again performing the ceremonies of fees and triplicate forms in front of sceptical congregations of war reporters needing visas. The security service was again putting people in their characterless cars. Outside the cities, there were only Abdul Haq, Gassim, and Aziz, who with each ungainly stride were carrying a new culture into rural Afghanistan. like modern Alexander the Greats.
Rory Stewart reading from his account of a 600-mile walk across Afghanistan, the places in between through largely ungoverned and maybe ungovernable territory. We'll talk about that. Roger's calling from Mapleville, Rhode Island. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, good to have you, Roger. What do you think?
Good morning, Mr. Stewart.
Hello.
I was just wondering if you ever felt the presence in your travels of Miss Freya Stark.
Ah, Miss Freya Stark. Yeah, very much.
Oh,
very much.
Boy.
Who had walked before you, long before you. Tell us that story, Rory.
Well, Freya Stark was an incredibly intrepid female explorer who was a great figure in the early part of the century, both in the British-administered territories of the Middle East and elsewhere. And there was a great deal of competition at that time. Another British explorer called Wilfred Thesiger said about her in a very sneering way, she did nothing that couldn't have been done by a second secretary from the embassy on his long vacation.
Boy, that is snippy. Of course, he wrote the Mars Arabs. She wrote Valley of the Assassins, I think?
Exactly. And she indeed also visited the Minaret of Jam, which is bang in the center of Afghanistan.
Roger, have you read Freya Stark?
Yes, I have, and that's why I called. It's just the more things change, the more they remain the same, Mr. Stewart. Isn't it so, or do you think it's gotten worse?
I think in some ways Afghanistan isn't quite as bad as we think. And as you say, that's partly because in many ways what's happening in Afghanistan now is not very different from what's happened at different periods in its history. And if we keep our expectations low and don't expect Afghanistan to radically alter, remember it is a country that's between Tajikistan and Pakistan that's had a very violent and troubled past, I think we'd be less gloomy about its prospects at the moment.
Just don't set the bar too high. We'll talk about what that means. Roger, thanks for your call. Therese is calling from Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Therese, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Interesting about the previous caller, because I was calling in to say how jealous I am that as a woman I wouldn't find it even a possibility to do such an adventure, though I think it's fabulous. Wouldn't you agree?
Rory?
I think it is perhaps more difficult for a woman, although you'd find in Afghanistan that people can be incredibly courteous and hospitable and generous. And in some ways you might find as a woman, and I live in Afghanistan now where I run a foundation, and I have a number of female colleagues who find that they are able to travel quite safely in many parts of the country, sometimes ironically more safely than the man because they're perceived as less of a threat. But nevertheless, I'm not sure I'd recommend this walk.
Can you imagine a woman doing this alone? I mean, did Freya Stark do it alone in the 1930s? Could a woman do it today? New York Times describes your book, as I recall, something like a Turkish bath of masculinity, because everywhere you are, almost everywhere, there are no women around. They're entirely out of sight from you.
That's absolutely right. I didn't, in fact, meet a woman for most of the walk. In fact, for most of my 20 months walk across Asia, I didn't see a woman, largely because the villagers would see me coming from a distance away and the women would hide. The exception was in central Afghanistan, where I finally managed to have a six-minute conversation with a 55-year-old woman who said to me that she had never been more than 3 hours' walk from her village. And the market town I'd walked from that morning, Yakolang, seemed to her almost as distant as Paris. And she could make very little sense of my claim that I'd walked from Turkey.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild claim, a pretty wild thing to have done at all. Therese in Lansing, thanks very much for your call. You relied a lot on the kindness, all the time on the kindness of strangers, and particularly on the Islamic tradition of hospitality. I wish you'd describe how that worked. Again and again in this book, it's the snow is pelting down, you're freezing in your boots, you've walked, I don't know, miles and miles in the day, and you're banging on the door of some headman in a village who has no idea you're showing up in the dark, and then you put the screws to them to stand up to the reputation for Islamic hospitality.
Well, that's right. And of course, this is a bit unfair of me because these communities are extremely poor communities and they were incredibly generous to me along the way. And often in order to leave some kind of payment, I would have to hide a $10 note under a cushion in the house and only tell my host when we were some way outside the village. Otherwise, he'd refuse to take it. But in order to get into a house, an incredible amount of courtesy and manners has to go into it. Afghanistan's an extremely polite society. So I would start by saying, Assalamu alaikum, chatorastid, hubastid, bahairastid, hanahariatas, jorastid, jahanjorast, mandanabashi, which is to say, peace be with you, How is your house? How is your health? How is your family? Long life to you. May you not be tired. And he would reply back at the same pace over the top. And for me, that was a very important ritual because in replying, in a sense, he was acknowledging me as a fellow human. And I became very disturbed later when I got into Taliban territories if people wouldn't respond to my greetings. And then I'd try to force them by saying again, don't you speak Persian? And they'd say, yes, I speak Persian. And I'd say again, peace be with you. How are you? How is your health?
If you could just get them to respond in kind, you had worked your way onto a plane of Islamic tradition, and them recognizing you as a human that bought you some kind of protection and maybe more, very often a bed and a meal. Rory, what was the daily pattern like? How many miles a day? What was the place you would lay your head down at night? What kind of food? Get visceral for us.
I usually walk between 20 and 25 miles a day, which is to say that I walk 8 or 9 hours a day. And I usually stop for an hour at lunchtime. I'm carrying a pack which isn't very heavy, weighs probably 25, 30 pounds at the most. In Afghanistan, I generally lived simply on bread. In the winter, there isn't any fruit or vegetables in the villages, and there's no meat either. And in Iran, generally on bread and cheese, and in Pakistan on bread and lentils, and in Nepal on rice and lentils. And essentially, you simply get into the routine of waking up very early at dawn, because, of course, people in villages tend to get up at first light. You sleep in a room with, if you're lucky, to get inside a village house, often with 8 or 9 men sleeping in the guest room with you, which is pretty noisy and pretty smelly, of course, because there isn't any water, so people generally don't wash during the winter months, or they don't wash their upper body during the winter months. The routine for me then was simply about heading east almost every day. I would talk to the villagers and sit down and say, look, I'm trying to walk to Kabul. And often an old man would say, my grandfather did that. And the route he took was, and often they could list off villages over about 150 miles ahead.
Though for many, you were exercising a privilege they did not have, that local rivalries meant many didn't make a walk like this, couldn't think of it.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this was one of the things that surprised me, that whereas I received enormous hospitality because of vendettas and killing in central Hazarajat, villages which were only 10 miles apart hadn't spoken to each other for a decade or more.
I cannot fail to ask you to introduce your canine Alexander on this journey, who became such a companion to you. I don't want to turn it into a pet show, but yet there was a dog in your life on this trip eventually that meant a great deal.
There was indeed. He was a mastiff, a fighting dog, who'd been used by a village to guard their sheep.
But the size of a small pony, you describe him.
The size of a small pony. He'd had a difficult life. He'd had his ears chopped off. He'd had his tail chopped off. He'd had his teeth knocked out. And I came across him in this village, and when I went forward to touch him, a young boy who'd spent the last 8 years memorizing the Quran said, no, you can't touch him, it's forbidden in the Quran. And I said to him, well, where in the Quran does it say it's forbidden to touch a dog? And he said, I don't know. And I said, but I thought you'd memorized the whole Quran. And he said, yes, but I memorized it in Arabic, and I don't speak Arabic. Anyway, I took this dog with me, and we had the most extraordinary relationship because he was almost autistic. I mean, he'd played by himself. He had very little relations with humans. And gradually over the 3 weeks that we walked together, he began to trust me more and more. And it was in one moment when I sat down on a snow plane in the center of Afghanistan and had almost given up, I think.
Because it was too cold, too late, too long a day, just too much.
Just too much. The sight of Babur coming towards me, sniffing around my neck, barking a couple of times, and then lifting his leg, put everything into proportion and, in a sense, saved my life. And he set off across the plain, and I set off behind him.
He makes much of the trip with you and kind of pulls you through, and you pulling him a lot of the time as well, but a kind of mental health anchor, among other things here. I mentioned you work now for something called the Turquoise Mountain Foundation. I wish you'd describe for us what that reference is, Turquoise Mountain, and then something about how you came across the Minaret of Jam.
Well, the Turquoise Mountain was a city which existed in central Afghanistan 800 years ago and was the capital of a great empire that stretched from Delhi to Baghdad. But in 1216, it was destroyed by Genghis Khan and his armies and lost to history. and archaeologists kept looking for it and were unable to find it. And in 1957, a Frenchman came across in the center of Afghanistan a very tall tower. It's 180 feet high.
Beautiful, ornate.
Incredibly beautiful. And he called it the Minaret of Jam after the village that was nearby, and speculated at the time that this might have been the site of this fabled lost city of the Turquoise Mountain. In fact, however, archaeologists dug there for 20 years and they couldn't find anything, and they concluded that the place where this tower was so narrow, so inaccessible, it only gets the sun for a couple of hours a day, that there was simply no way that the capital of a great empire could have been based there.
But here you are, you show up in 2002 sort of stumbling in after a long walk out of the snow, clamber through a hole in the side of the tower 4 feet up, climb up, look out, and see?
Absolutely. Well, I climb up and I look out and I suddenly see trenches dug all the way across the hillside. And I come down out of the tower and I climb up the side of the hill. Now, I'll read you a little bit from the book, which is, just describes this moment. After tea, I climbed up the hill beside the tower. The gravel was loose and the slope steep, and I needed to use my hands. I found myself clambering over rough trenches, some almost 10 feet deep. Along the rim of the pits were piles of sand and broken fragments of pottery. I passed shards of brilliant yellow porcelain, half a terracotta bowl, a section of ancient guttering, and some new spades and pickaxes. Clearly the antique robbers did not steal each other's tools. Those digging had made no attempt to preserve the shape of the buildings they had found. Only in a tiny section on the ridge could you even trace the walls of the rooms. The villagers were tunneling as deep and as quickly as possible to reach whatever lay beneath, and destroying a great deal in the process. The trenches, which had been invisible from the base of the tower, now stretched across every slope in sight. The villagers had clearly succeeded where the archaeologists had failed, and had uncovered an ancient city. Now, I saw these villagers bringing out of the ground ivory chess pieces, carved wooden doors, fragments of porcelain manufactured in China in the late 12th century. They had basically uncovered, in the 3 weeks since the Taliban had fallen, the remains of this incredible ancient empire, and were in the process of selling the pieces for a dollar a time to antique collectors, where they would then float through to the Middle East and London and Paris and New York.
The most remarkable
thing. Their provenance
thing.
Would be lost.
Lost. And the Turquoise Mountain, the city being resurfaced here, but in the most chaotic, haphazard, history-destroying way.
Exactly. And such a tragedy. They said to me, this is the city that was destroyed by Genghis Khan. And I said, you're destroying it a second time. You're destroying what remains. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a call from Lubbock, Texas. Anne's on the line. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Amazing journey. I just wanted to know more about your foundation and the name of it. And my specific question was, I had heard shortly after the Taliban had destroyed the Buddhas in Banyan that there was some initiative going with Laura Bush, and then it just disappeared off the radar about replacing them or repairing or doing something. And I wondered if you'd heard anything about that and wanted more information about your foundation. Thanks.
Thank you, Anne. Rory, you walked through Bamiyan on your way to Kabul. You saw the great gaping holes in the wall where the Buddhas had stood. What did you learn there, and what are you up to now with Turquoise Mountain Foundation?
Well, as you say, I came through Bamiyan, and I saw not just that, but I saw beautiful frescoed caves from the 8th century, which the Taliban had burnt and then stamped their shoes all over the ceiling of the caves. The Turquoise Mountain Foundation is an Afghan social foundation, and we are investing in Afghan traditional crafts and in Afghan historic buildings and landscapes. And we believe that by doing so, we can help to preserve these things. We can help to develop a sense of Afghan national identity and hopefully even create some economic opportunities for young Afghan craftsmen and to perhaps attract visitors from the region or inside Afghanistan. So one of the big projects we're focused on at the moment is trying to work on the restoration of the old city of Kabul on the north bank of the Kabul River, and particularly the 18th and 19th century wooden and mud buildings, which are very beautiful but in a very decrepit state along that part of the river.
So now here you are, having established your own NGO, but in the book you're harshly critical of the interventions of many international agencies, complimentary of their staff who know the language and who invest, but overall very critical of what I'm sure a lot of people from afar see as important charitable, philanthropic, humanitarian work. Why?
Well, it's very difficult to express this without irritating people. But my sense is that because of the security situation partly and because of the way that we now think in the West, people are very reluctant to get out on the ground or even prevented from getting out on the ground by their insecurity regulations. This means that we produce these very, very general theoretical models of how to work in a country like Afghanistan, which is the sort of McKinsey of state building. So I remember turning up in January 2002 and hearing the Afghan finance minister say to the donors, every Afghan is committed to a gender-sensitive, multi-ethnic, centralized state committed to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law.
And now, you come out of the villages where this sounds like so much gibberish from a distant planet.
Absolutely. It's very, very difficult for me to imagine even how I would set about translating that to a headman in a village. And the point is that these communities are very different each from the other. One community will have suffered very badly under the Taliban. So for 4 days, I walked through villages which had been burnt to the ground. I went to Yakalang, where 400 people had been executed against a village wall. In the next community, a new religious leader will have taken over. 50 miles further down the road, an old feudal chief will be ruling. And these political and social structures are very, very new, very vulnerable. And often I'm worried that the vision of the international community is so radically idealistic in its belief that we can somehow replace these traditional structures almost overnight with technocrats, educated people coming out from Kabul who are apparently going to overnight create the kind of clean, effective government, which of course Afghans want, but I think it's going to be very difficult to achieve if we hurry too much into it.
But is the alternative, the international community, kind of giving new life to feudalism? Is it just, you know, extending something that can look awfully backward, even in your up-close description sometimes?
Absolutely. I think the important thing for the international community is to keep the objective in mind. And of course, the objective for us, as for Afghans, is to have, in the end, a full functioning democracy with a clean and effective government. All I'm disagreeing with is the way that we set about getting there. And I'm worried that if we push too fast and we topple too many of these regional power holders, we may end up creating an anarchic vacuum instead. All I'm really saying is that this kind of project is not just about economics. It's not just about guns. It's really about politics. And it's about very, very detailed local knowledge of local communities.
Roy Stewart reminds us of the old, old model of the kind of British colonial district commissioner who would know the villages as well as he got to know some of them on his way across Afghanistan. Abdul's calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Abdul. You're on the air.
Hi. I really enjoy your program.
Thank you.
My question is, can you tell us the difference between the Taliban extremism and regular people? And my second question is, are you going to learn Islam by yourself? Since you learn the culture of Afghanistan, are you going to plan to learn Islam?
Abdul, your line is rough, but let me pick those up and thank you for your call. Rory, first question, did you see the difference between Taliban-style, extremist-style Islam and regular Islam? Did you see a difference, as Abdul asked? And secondly, now that you've learned all the Islamic culture, are you going on over?
Right. Well, I think the answer to the first question is that this was often a matter of degree and a matter of village. Some people had a much more conservative vision of social codes, but many, many Afghans were very pleased at the opportunity now that women could get education again and were sad and embarrassed by what the Taliban had done to what they saw as a good, moderate vision of Islam. As to whether I'd actually myself become a Muslim, I think I'm a Christian and I come from a Christian family and I feel that we have one God and it's the same God as exists in all these religions. I think my parents would be unhappy were I to convert.
Were you tempted? Are you suggesting that, or are you being facetious?
No, I was. That was slightly tongue in cheek. I think the answer is that one's religion, in many ways, owes a lot to where one's grown up, and I feel very comfortable as a Christian in Afghanistan, and I feel that I'm treated with a lot of respect and kindness by Afghans as a Christian.
Though you're right, and maybe tongue-in-cheek again, a couple of points, especially when you met the Taliban approaching Kabul, you became a very Muslim Christian in order to survive those moments. Winston's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Winston, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Stewart, would you be interested in doing this trip again?
Yes, I am very interested in doing these kind of trips again. I plan towards the end of this year to travel in other parts of Afghanistan that I haven't seen. And for me, it's the greatest privilege in the world to be able to explore valleys where people don't go very much anymore and to meet new communities and interact with them.
Rory, to that point, though, we heard from Carlotta Gall of the New York Times, who you know at the top of the hour, on the latest fighting in the South, where the Taliban, as she describes it, is strongly resurgent. You warn against radical idealism in our ambitions for remaking a country like Afghanistan. But what about the minimum? I mean, many American troops are there now, and NATO, British, and the rest, trying to just have a secure and stable country. Is that in the cards? Is that coming, or are we dreaming?
I think that we've got to be careful not to actually upset things by doing too much. I think it's very tempting when things look as though they're not going well, when it looks as though Taliban groups are mobilizing, when it looks like the drug trade is developing as it is, when warlords are consolidating their power, to think that this is somehow something that we need to deal with by bringing in more troops and more money. We have a very optimistic attitude in the West. We believe we can solve any problem. We've just got to sort out the tactics. We've got to throw more resources at it. My instinct is slightly different. I reckon that we should be putting much more faith in President Karzai, who I think is a remarkably effective politician. And we should be working through him and enabling him to make the kinds of compromises and negotiations with the provincial power holders that he knows how to do. I think it's very dangerous for us to set about trying unilaterally to confront these power holders, because I think we may well end up creating some of the kind of situation we have in Iraq if we do this too aggressively.
But what's to keep Afghanistan from returning to Taliban control and maybe once again even an operations base for al-Qaeda, for international terrorism, if the U.S. and NATO pull back?
I'm not suggesting we leave the country. I think we've got the balance right over the last 3 to 4 years, which is to say that we should have NATO and American troops in the country. We should have foreign support for the government. But we should make absolutely certain that that support is funneled through the Afghan government. The Afghan president is supported to the hilt. One of the things that makes me sad is the international community can be quite quick to accuse the Afghan president of not doing what they like, of being weak, of making political deals that they don't like. I think that's very, very dangerous. I think our only hope here is to try to do what we've done, I think, quite well over the last 3 to 4 years. And of course, there are going to be big problems. I mean, as I said earlier on, Afghanistan has had a very, very difficult and violent past, and it's going to remain probably for the next 20 years a very, very difficult, probably quite poor and unstable country. So what we need to try to do is manage that and make sure that that management is going in the right direction. But I think panicking because there's been an upsurge of Taliban movements in the south or because drug growing is happening might actually make the situation worse rather than better.
Slow and steady, not too deep an imprint, maybe not too high a bar set for the goals, and know it intimately is what I'm hearing, your prescription. A remarkable journey, Rory Stewart. I hope we can hear from you again. I know you've got another book coming out on some time in Iraq. Perhaps you'll come back and share something on that with us as well. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Rory Stewart joined us from London. He is now chief executive of the Turquoise Mountain Foundation. His book, and I highly recommend it, is The Places in Between. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.